Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om namo.
Can you turn the fan on too?
Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam. We're continuing with Prahlad Maharaj's instructions to his demoniac schoolmates. And it will just take me 1 minute to figure out where we are. Okay, actually we're on chapter 7, what Prahlad learned in the womb. We made progress there also. Yes. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt your chanting. So Prahlad describes to his schoolmates, because they had asked him where he got all this knowledge from. This is impressive. He was speaking Harikatha, teaching them all the intricacies of devotional service, and they knew nothing about it, and they said, you grew up in the palace with your father, and you just come to this school. How did you know anything about this? And then Prahlad related the history of how his mother, Kayadu, had been pregnant with him, and Indra and some of his men came and kidnapped her when Hiranyakashipu was off performing austerities, and they had planned to kill the child when he came out because they thought he would be in the same mood as Hiranyakashipu, and they didn't want double trouble for the universe. And Narada Muni intervened, and he told them that this is not a demoniac child in the womb. It's actually a great devotee, and they accepted, and Prabhupada said, this is parampara. You hear from somebody who knows what they're talking about, and you accept it. And that's what they did. So he took Kayadu to his ashram, and he took care of her. And while he did, he gave constant instruction about devotional service. And she was listening, but more intently listening was Prahlad Maharaj, who was within the womb. And that's where he became enlightened, but from hearing from Narada and also from getting the mercy of Narada. It's also very prominent in this Leela about the mercy of the Vaishnava and the spiritual master, because throughout his prayers, Prahlad Maharaj refers to his being a servant of his spiritual master, and how this is how he came to the position that he's in now, was the mercy of his spiritual master. That's how he came to know Lord Nrsingadev, and that Narada was actually projecting his mercy to Prahlad in the womb. So he became very advanced because of that and hearing from him. So then Prahlad began speaking to his classmates some of the things that he had heard while he was in the womb. And one of the things that we heard last time was that he told them that an expert geologist can see an area of land and discern that there's gold in that land because he knows the terrain, he knows what an area looks like when it has gold, even though to the untrained eye, it just looks like land. So for a person trained in atmatattva, spiritual truth, that person can see where the soul is active. And as described in the Sri Shapanishad, Yasmin Sarvani Bhutani Atmaivad Budvijanataha Tatrako Mahakasho Ka Ekatvanuma Anupashita. One who systematically sees all living entities as spiritual sparks and quality one with the Lord becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? And systematic means, in Sanskrit, the word systematic is anupashyati. So anu means to follow and pashyati means to see. So one who follows the system of seeing by hearing from parampara, that means shastra and from guru and from sadhus, you hear the truth as it's passed down, and when you hear it, then you can understand the correct thing. You get knowledge in that way, and you organize your life accordingly. So Prahlad Maharaj is telling all these things to his classmates, and he continues. He says that a sober and expert person should search for the spirit soul with minds purified through analytical study in terms of the soul's connection with the distinction from all things that undergo creation, maintenance, and destruction. Purport: a sober person can study himself and distinguish the soul from the body by analytical study. Hare Krishna. So this is an important point, that a sober person can study himself and distinguish the soul from the body by analytical study. So that means we can stop at any time and introspect and decide by looking carefully at our consciousness and the body with what is what. Are you, for instance, now you're sitting here and you can feel that you have a body. You can feel the weight of it. There's some earth in the body. It's a material element. In fact, when you take a dead body and you burn it, then you get a jar full of ashes. And I've seen it because I've both of my parents left me their ashes, and you know, I got, after the crematorium, you know, the body comes out to be a jar about this big. And it's a revelation. If you've ever been to a funeral in India also, in America, the body's burned in a very special enclosed environment. I went to that also, and it's a gigantic furnace, and the body goes inside the furnace, and then it goes up to very high heat, and then they bring the ashes out later. But in India, in some places, you go to the burning ghat, and there's a big pile of wood, and then the body goes right on top of the wood, and then the fire is lit. Do you ever go to one? Did you? Yeah. And I had a visceral reaction the first time I saw it, like, oh no, you can't burn that, because the body appears to be the self, and we identify with the body. In fact, I told the story the other night, which was told by Hiranyakashipu, about the king who is the Suyagya, who is the king of Ushinara province, who had died on the battlefield, and then his followers and his wives had come, his queens had come out to lament over the body, even past the time when the body was to be burned. And then Yamaraj, in the form of a little boy, came there and asked them, why are you all crying? And they said, our king has died. He's gone. He said, no, he's not gone. He's right there. He said, no, no, he's gone. He said, no, he's right here. Look, same eyes, same hands, same hair. How can you say he's gone? And they said, no, you don't understand, little boy. He died. And he said, but I don't understand what you're saying, because he's still right there. And then they said, who are you? And he said, I'm Yamaraj. I've come here because you're lamenting for something you should not lament for. The body is left behind, and it's just the empty vehicle now. And he said, actually, you never saw the king. You said the king is gone, but he's right there. So where is he? If he's gone, that means you never saw him. Someone's father dies and they say, my father's gone. And they say, no, he's right there. So did you see him or not? No, I never saw him. So we can analyze ourselves of which part of the body actually is the part that's burned and ends up in a jar. There's water. 80% of the body is water. You can feel that if you squeeze your arm. You can see that it's got some liquid in it, right? Well, that's not me, because, you know, the liquid comes out and I still go on with my life. So there's earth, water, and then there's fire. There's some heat in your body. It's generating heat all the time. Air. If you feel your breath go in and out, you can distinguish that the breath is separate from your consciousness or the person who's witnessing the air come in and out. And then it gets more subtle. Then there's the mind element. And you can actually observe your mind if you sit quietly and don't cooperate with it for a minute. And that is meaning the mind's pulling me here and there. And if I just think I am my mind, I go wherever it goes and that's who I am. And I identify with the different movements of the mind. I don't notice, but if I sit and I analyze where the mind's going, I can see that I'm observing the mind moving from one object to the next. And very rarely is the mind in the present. This is a state of self-realization when one's actually feels oneself in the present. This is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma, Nashochati Nakankshati, Samak Sarveshu Bhuteshu Madbhaktim Labhate Param. Krishna says that the business of the mind normally is shochati and kankshati, that means hankering and lamenting, or accepting and rejecting. The mind accepts one thing, and then it rejects the next day. My wife notices it all the time. She feeds me at home, and I'll say, I like apples. And she'll buy apples, and then a week later, say, I don't like apples. 2 weeks later, where's the apples? You said you don't like apples. I like them again. The mind goes, say, I like that sweater. You get the sweater. 2 weeks later, I don't like the sweater. And on and on. When I was a child, I liked toys. I died for my toys. But now I don't care for them anymore. I've left them behind. It's changing. And it's hankering and then lamenting. It hankers for something, it gets it, and it laments when it loses it. And it's dwelling in the past or it's dwelling in the future. Future means I'm worrying about what might happen in the future. I'm conjecturing about what kind of situation I might get myself into. Will the IRS call or will they not? What's going to happen? Will I get skin cancer from all the years I spent in the sun as a kid? There's so many things that you can think of that might happen in the future. The mind rallies towards the future, and then in the past, it thinks of things that it's done before, different impressions it had. But in the Brahma-Bhuta position, Brahma-Bhuta-Prasanatma, one becomes happy just existing. And knowing that I exist is a happy state, because we don't only exist now, but we exist permanently. There's no end to that. In that realization, there's some happiness, ananda, prasanatma. It's actually a lifting of a great burden, that I think that this body is going to be vanquished at some point, or that I'm going to be vanquished. But when I realized I can never be vanquished, that's big news, isn't it? Or is it just me? You find out that I can't be killed. Everybody knows that. Yeah, it's something that is, and if it's theoretical, you know, I can hear about it. Prabhupada mentioned that no one wants to give up their body. He said an old man who's sick, struggling, lying on the bed, and then someone comes and says, well, here, I'll shoot you. And he'll say, no, please don't shoot me. Even if I'm suffering and I have arthritis and I can barely move, I can't digest, and someone says, well, I'll just shoot you. And no, please don't shoot me. I become attached to the body. So here, we're hearing that a sober person can study himself and distinguish the soul from the body by analytical study. So we should do this. You take time to look and introspect and see who you are and analyze. Am I the body or am I something else? And by that analysis, I can have a clear goal in life. Who am I to take care of? Just the body? Or should the body just be maintained in a minimal way, in a simple way, because it's a bad investment? If you get an apartment, let's say, and you're living in the apartment, you come home one day and the landlord has put up a very clear sign on your door, and it starts with the word E, and the next letter is V, and the next letter is I. It's eviction notice. And he says, 30 days eviction notice, order of the court, you have to leave here. And the next day, I go to Home Depot and I buy all kinds of new things and carpet and drapery, and I have the place cleaned and buy new furniture. This is a kind of madness. So along with our birth, Krishna says, death is certain. From when it was born, death is certain. We don't even know when that's coming, but we already have the eviction notice. Basically, we're on death row. I always wondered what would be like death, life on death row when I heard about it when I was a kid. Sometimes we'd drive in San Francisco and my parents would point out, there's San Quentin. You know, San Quentin's the big prison over in San Francisco. And they tell me, oh, prisoners, they live in there. They can never come out. And some of them live in these cells and they're just waiting to be executed. And I just thought that was such a horrible thing. And then I thought about it later that I'm in that situation too. I'm in a cell, basically, and any time I can be, I'm only waiting for that number. They don't know when they're going to be executed. The number can come up at any time. So I'm in a similar situation. It's an analytical study to see what situation I'm in now. And then to find out what I can do about it, that's intelligence. This is what the Vedas say. Find out a solution for this. All other solutions are superfluous. Many good causes in the world, but don't miss the great cause on account of going for the good causes, because there's one great cause, and that is to get free from this situation that I'm in now. Part of it is by analytical study. Then Prabhupada says, for example, when one considers his body, his head, his hands, and so on, one can certainly understand the difference between the spirit, soul, and the body. No one says, I head. Everyone says, what? My head. So this is a really important linguistic point here. What's the difference between I and my? My I becomes my, right? It indicates possession. It means I own something, I control something, but it doesn't mean I am that thing. So just through the language, we can understand that we're not the body, because I don't say I body. I say my body, my head, my hands, my eyes. And think about it. Those eyes that you have now, they're lenses that have been loaned to you. And, you know, they're a little machine that are working somehow. It's on loan to you. By material nature, Bhagavatam says, Labham sudurlabham idam bahusam bhavante manushyam artadam anityam apihadhira. Bhagavatam says that the body you have now, especially the human body, which is called manusha, human bodies are especially rare. It's very highly tuned equipment. It's very special technology, the human body. It's got built into it the ability to comprehend, contemplate, and comprehend the idea that I'm not the body, and to exercise free will, and to become free from fear, and also to ask what is the ultimate, Brahman, or some people say God. What is that concept, the greatest thing from which everything else emanates? What is the root cause of everything? That facility is available in the human form of life. So it's a very, very rare opportunity, and the human body can do that. So we can also distinguish the difference between I and mine. No one says I head, everyone says my head. Thus there are two entities, the head and I. They are not identical, although they appear to be one conglomeration. One may argue, when we analyze the body, we find a head, hands, legs, a belly, blood, bones, urine, stool, and so on. But after everything is considered, where is the existence of the soul? When I was in Hawaii a few years ago, the devotees invited me to come speak at a few classrooms, and I didn't know that some of them were going to be youngsters. They were some of them, I think, in 7th, 8th grade. And they're not really interested in philosophy, I can tell you right now. I wasn't used to that. And so the first class I went into, I did my best to talk about philosophy and explain to them. And some of them were like, gave me the body language, like, you know, when's this going to be over? And then another devotee who is used to doing these kinds of classes gave the next class, and I watched him. And he got up in the middle, in the front of the class, and he played Simon Says. He said, okay, do you guys ever play Simon Says? And they said, yeah. And he said, let's play. And so he said, okay, Simon Says, point your arm. Simon says, point to your nose. And he went on like this, and more people dropped out. You know how to play Simon Says, right? Okay. So then he said, point to yourself. Simon says, point to yourself. The last kid standing was very proud. He made it all the way in. He said, point to yourself. And he was thinking, where do I point to? And all the kids, yeah, come on, Larry, point to yourself. So he was wondering. And that was the starting point of the lecture. The devotee drew a picture of a body, and then he said, the Atma, the self. What is the actual self? What is yourself? Beyond the hand, you said, point to your hand, point to your nose, point to your ear, now point to yourself. And so that started the conversation that there's an entity that is the consciousness behind the body. And Krishna says, this is knowledge. Kshetrajnam chapimam vidhi sarva kshetrishu bharata. Kshetra kshetrajnayo jnanam yattach jnanam atammama. Krishna says, this is my opinion, what real knowledge is, and that is to understand that the body is a field, and you're the knower of the field. You know the field, you're observing the field. And if you understand the difference between the field and the knower of the field, you have knowledge. If you don't have that, you don't have anything. You're simply an animal. You're an animal consciousness. So human consciousness, enlightened consciousness, means knowing the difference between the field and the knower of the field. And then even a higher step above this is understanding that there's a super knower. Where is it that intelligence comes from? Jonas Salk, who came up with a very complicated explanation of photosynthesis, said that he practically one day, after contemplating for many, many months, tripped over the formula. It came into his mind as if fully prepared. He worked on it for so long, and then it came into his mind from where? From the ether, from the super soul, from the super knower. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto mattak smritir jnanam apovanam cha, that the super soul, that is, there's a soul that is also fully conscious, and I'm fully conscious. I'm not fully conscious, but I'm minutely conscious, and I'm being provided for by that super soul. Mozart used to he would listen to one concert, and he'd go home and he'd remember the whole thing and write it all down. And the music that he wrote, he'd just sit down and it would flow out of him onto the paper. He said he would have to be careful not to trip over it in the morning, because it was so he was so prolific, and it just flowed from his subconscious, this music. And all of us work in the same way. We may not be aware of it, but by analytical study, we should also see, where is our intelligence coming from? When your intelligence is blocked, what can you do? You ever have a situation where you slept and then you woke up and you were only partially aware? I had that situation once. I was in Dallas, Texas, and I was distributing books at the airport there, and I went out to the parking lot to have a little prasadam and take a nap. And I fell asleep in the car in the 100-degree weather. And I woke up, and I honestly didn't know where I was. It took me 5 minutes to actually, you know, for the blood to come back into my brain and realize that I'm in Dallas, Texas. I'm somewhere. And that's interesting. I'm in Dallas, Texas. But I really didn't know for a few minutes. And welcome. Thank you for coming. Hi. And so we're dependent. Our intelligence is dependent on a higher source. So this is knowledge, to understand the difference between our consciousness and the field of activity, like this body, which is sometimes described, as Krishna calls it in the Bhagavad Gita, the city of nine gates. Isn't that interesting? Think of your body. What is it? It's a city. And you live in the city. The nine gates are there. The holes throughout your body, these are the nine gates. And really, they are gates out to the world, you know, through which you take in information from the environment. And we live in this city of nine gates, and then at a particular time arranged by material nature, we have to relocate. We get evicted from that situation. Utkramantam stitam vapi bhunjanam va gunanvitam. Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita as ukramantam. So krama means to step, and you step outside your body. You step out. The body no longer has a usefulness. The time is up. You have to move out. And there's a science about transmigration. What body then do you next take? It depends on your consciousness. So all this, Prahlad Maharaj is describing to his schoolmates, and Prabhupada is unpacking this. He says, one may argue, when we analyze the body, we find a head, hands, legs, a belly, blood, bones, urine, stool, and so on. But after everything is considered, where is the existence of the soul? A sober man, however, avails himself of this Vedic instruction. Yatova imani bhutani jayante, yena jayanti jivanti, yat pravant yabibishnava shanti, tad vigna sasva tad brahmeti. From the Taittiriya Upanishad. Thus he can understand that the head, hands, legs, and indeed the entire body have grown on the basis of the soul. If the soul is within, the body, head, hands, and legs grow. But otherwise, they do not. A dead child does not grow up, for the soul is not present. If by a careful analysis of the body one still cannot find the existence of the soul, this is due to his ignorance. How can a gross man fully engaged in materialistic activities understand the soul, which is a small particle of spirit, 1/10,000th the size of the tip of the hair? Such a person foolishly thinks that the material body has grown from a combination of chemicals, although he cannot find them. The Vedas inform us, however, that chemical combinations do not constitute the living force. The living force is the Atma and Paramatma, and the body grows on the basis of that living force. The fruit of a tree grows and undergoes six kinds of changes because of the presence of the tree. If there were no tree, there could be no question of the growth and maturity of the fruit. Therefore, beyond the existence of the body are the Paramatma and Atma within the body. This is the first understanding of spiritual knowledge explained in Bhagavad Gita. Dehino sminyata dehe. The body exists because of the presence of the Supreme Lord and the Jiva, which is part of the Lord. This is further explained by the Lord himself in Bhagavad Gita 9.4. Mayata tamidam sarvam jagadavyakta murtina matstani sarvabhutani nachaham teshvavastita. By me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. The Supreme Soul exists everywhere. The Vedas enjoin sarvam kalavidam brahma. Everything is Brahman or an expansion of Brahman's energies. Sutri manigana iva. Everything rests on the Lord just like pearls strung together on a thread. The thread is the principal Brahman. He is the supreme cause, the supreme Lord upon whom everything rests. Matak paratanam nanyat. Thus we must study the Atma and Paramatma, the individual soul and the supersoul, upon whom the entire material cosmic manifestation rests. This is explained by the Vedic statement, Yatova imani bhutani jayante yena jayanti jivanti. Pearls on a thread. Just think of this example for a minute. When you see pearls strung on a thread, you see a necklace. It has shape, and when I see a necklace, I don't see the string, ideally. And the material world has shape, it has order, it has form, and Krishna says, sutri manigana iva, just like pearls are strung on a thread, so the order that you see around you comes from my support. And that includes how the body is manifested. The mechanics that are going on in the material world automatically, the sun is rising and setting, the body is digesting, and the heart is beating. And all these things are going on due to the superior force of the supreme Atma, the supreme personality of Godhead. They're not by my force. So an important aspect of self-realization, as we said, is to differentiate between the body and the self, and then to become aware of the super-self. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam eko bahunam yovididhati kaman. This is an easy one, and that is to see that there are, I'm being supplied. What are some things I'm being supplied with? Huh? Everything be specific. Here, we have a scientist just came in. He can help us. What are we being supplied with?
Water, heat.
Okay, I'm getting water. What else?
Air.
Air?
Sunshine.
Food.
Food's a good one. Where does that all come from?
Water,
plant a seed in the ground and it grows. It's like a miracle, right? Intelligence. The functions of the functionality of the body is beyond my comprehension. That's why I go to a doctor when it becomes disjointed, because I don't know how it works, right? And neither do most doctors, to be frank. Oh, because if you go to them and say, "Can you cure me?" they will say what? Most of the time they'll say no. And then the other times they'll say, we'll give it a shot. And a lot of the times they make you worse than you were when you came in. It's a really good place to get sick is go to a hospital. There's a lot of, flesh-eating viruses and all kinds of horrific things that happen. And that's because it's beyond our control. Disease is something that we can't just conquer. In fact, even in my lifetime, there was a conception that science had overcome tuberculosis, which was a big problem. And it was declared victory, that it was vanquished. And then miraculously, it came back with a vengeance, too. Many generations later, it came back. Not only did it come back, but it came back as a super strain. And they can't figure out how to get rid of it now. Very difficult. And the combinations, permutations, mutations of nature are endlessly mutable and inscrutable and very difficult to understand. They're beyond our comprehension. There is inconceivability even within material nature. I just think about a lemon seed for a minute. You got a picture of a lemon seed in your mind? What is that? It's a little factory or something. I mean, it's just with one seed, you can start a whole forest. One seed, you can plant it in the ground, grow it successfully. It'll grow up into a plant. That'll grow innumerable lemons on it. And you can take millions of seeds out of that and start a whole forest of lemon plants from one seed. And salivating for even thinking about lemons, right? And where does that come from? That automatic response when I offer you a lemon wedge and you begin to salivate and think about it. So all these things are going automatically, and Krishna is saying, Sutri Manigana Iva. These things, all these automatic goings on, are happening by my control, which is just an insignificant aspect of his total energies, the material energies, very insignificant, small portion. So becoming aware of how I'm situated in a body, how the body is inconceivably going on, how I'm getting intelligence, how everything's being supplied, and there is a supplier. Becoming aware that I'm supplied and there's a supplier. This is the beginning of being spiritually conscious. Moving about in the world in such a way, in fact, gratitude should grow from that. Appreciation that, look at a tree, for instance. It's holding out its arms and offering you all kinds of fruits, practically for free. A little bit of work required. All you have to do is cultivate it in a natural setting. You can get from a small plot of land enough food to feed a village. I've seen it over in Lafayette, where my parents lived for many years. Somebody started a tiny little, like half acre, started growing corn and some squash and tomatoes. And just from that one little plot of land that they had, with a little water, a little soil, a little light, and a few seeds, they had enough produce to sell to the whole city. Everyone would stop in there and buy from them, from that one little plot of land. So Krishna is supplying in many different ways. There are all kinds of innovations, way better than an iPad. iPad has all kinds of glitches, but just a lemon seed is millions of times more technologically intact and innovative than an iPad. And all around us, these kinds of things are going on. Inconceivability, how food is digested. I eat a salad. I eat some other. What else did I have today? And a baked potato. And there, it's being distributed. It's broken up into its component parts. The glucose gets broken down through some process. My brain gets fed by that glucose. Otherwise, I can't think and process. There's other proteins that are needed for the muscles. And there's a whole process that goes place, but I have no idea that it's taking place. It just does it. And then the elimination system is there. And throughout the night also, according to the Ayurvedic information, at every stage of the night, your body is cleansing a certain organ. Certain organs process through. It's just like when you turn on your dishwasher. If you have a dishwasher, you turn it on and it goes through cycles. And it's washing, then it's rinsing, and then it's drying, and then it opens, and then the buzzer goes off. And it's the same thing with your body. Throughout the night, it's going through each one of the organs. It regenerates. It's all set on automatic. And I have nothing to do with that. I'm just observing the whole thing. So Krishna says, Sutre mani gana iva, just like pearls are strung on a thread, all these things are going on. And when I become conscious that I'm the observer, I'm the recipient of all these things that are happening, that are moving in this way, well, there's a kind of a relief in one way. And also, when there's an understanding that there's really no scarcity, everyone's being provided. Jesus Christ taught his disciples to look at nature very carefully and see how things are going on. And one of the things he said was, look at the birds in the field. Personally, I love looking at the birds. There's lots of birds around my house because we have lots of gardens and trees, and they like it there. And, you know, they don't pay any rent. They don't have any insurance, and they just get up in the morning at the same time. I hear them. It's a miracle. I mean, it's actually, if I watch the birds, I see how every one of them has their food. There's a little plant I have growing in a pot right outside my door, and it's got thousands of tiny little red flowers. The hummingbird comes, and he touches his sharp beak into each one of those little flowers while he's flying, and he can practically hit about 100 perfect bullseyes in about 15 seconds. Boom, 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 just like that. He's perfectly equipped to eat that food. The food is provided for him. Other birds are flying around, and they can just catch the moths and the bugs flying in the air. Other ones look for the worms, and everyone's in business. There's no one out there, you know, on strike or saying that, you know, I don't like my wages or something like that. They just get up and they go. And the whole thing's happening automatically. So just as the birds are being fed, the animals are being fed, humans are being fed also. It just takes a tiny little bit of endeavor to take care of a few things. I mean, a tree and a plant and a few things. You have one cow and a bull. You can till the field and take care of all your economic necessities within one little tiny plot of land. That's a fact. And how does that all go on? Because there's a supplier. Somebody's supplying us all these things, and there's an ingenuity behind the whole thing, which is inconceivable, an intelligence, a brain. And so this is the beginning of self-realization, to see that I'm being maintained. and that there's a maintainer, and then to develop some appreciation, some gratitude for the maintainer. It's one thing to be a vegetarian, because then you think, well, I'm causing less harm, I don't slaughter animals, but it's a much higher concept to offer your food. It means out of gratitude, you take whatever you're going to eat before you eat it, and as a consciousness, you're saying, this was given to me as a gift. I'm offering it back out of gratitude. Does my infinite source need that? No, he's the source of everything, but he appreciates the gesture. And he says so in the Bhagavad Gita, a very simple thing. Patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhaktya priyachiti taraham bhakti paritam ashnami paritatmanaha. He says, if you offer me any of these simple things from nature, a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water. Water means what? Easy, doesn't it? Just like a library card. What's a library card? Easy. It's free. You can just go get a library card. Anybody can go to the library. Not many people do. Only 5% of the population, unfortunately. Water? Easy? Can you get water? It's a planet full of water. You can get water anywhere. And Krishna says, just offer me a little water. And if you do it with appreciation, with gratitude, with love, ashnami paritatmana, I'll accept it. There's a rasa there. There's an exchange through gratitude that I'm offering back to my infinite source, the Supreme Person. Then he comes into focus. That if I'm offering and somebody's accepting and I feel something in my heart when he accepts it, must be a person behind that. Before I came to the Christian Consciousness Movement, I used to read books and the conclusion would usually be that you worship God, then you become God. And then there would be prayers to the Supreme, and also even some of them a ritual for offering. And then I started thinking, wait a minute, who am I offering to? Myself? Who's accepting these things? Who's accepting the prayers? And bhakti means that there is a giver and there is an acceptor. And both have to be there. There's two things. And this is self-realization. And actually, it can be a very simple thing. As Prahlad Maharaj here is saying, if one is sober and analyzes how are things going on and who's making them go on and how am I receiving these gifts on a regular basis, a minute-to-minute basis, I become aware that I'm conscious and that there's a benevolent presence that is maintaining me at every second. This is Krishna consciousness, actually. This is the mentality of a person who's grown in spiritual consciousness, is to come to this feeling of God is absolutely good. Everything that he does is for my benefit. It's beyond this confusion of like, why do bad things happen to good people? A person who has come to spiritual consciousness sees the environment as friendly in all circumstances. And all this can be achieved practically through a simple process of analyzing that I'm not the body and that there's a supernova within the body who's supplying me intelligence and everything else that I need. And if I feel a twinge of gratitude, I've begun my progressive spiritual life. And if I direct that gratitude towards the source, Krishna, the Supreme Person, then he reciprocates. Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam. Priti means there's a kind of affection. I have an affectionate relationship with my creator and with my supplier. Affection. And that's the most relishable thing. In fact, the scriptures say that that's the only thing. Everyone's looking for this relationship, but we're looking for it in all kinds of ways that are not ultimately consummated, that cannot be satisfied completely. Relationships that I have in this world, there is some kind of semblance of rasa, that means exchange of love, but they're terminated. Either through misunderstanding or because of separation out of death or any other way, you know. So the Vedas are directing us, go back to your loving source. Go home. Home means where the heart is. And that home is where the Supreme Person, who is our best friend, our ever-well-wisher, is there offering us himself, his personal association. So every human being can achieve this. From whatever position he or she is in right now, every human being can achieve this through the process of Krishna consciousness, which means simply Krishna consciousness. When I say shine, any kind of shine means sunshine. I mean, where else does any shine come from? If it comes from a flashlight, did it come from somewhere else besides the sun? No, it's stored energy. That stored energy in a battery came from the sun. Any shine is sunshine. So any consciousness is Krishna consciousness. When we say Krishna, we mean the infinite source of all beauty, the source of all beauty, the source of all knowledge, the source of all strength, the source of all renunciation, the source of everything that is an admirable quality comes from Krishna. So anything I see that's conscious, that's, when I say consciousness, I mean Krishna consciousness. So it's a universal process, and the knowledge from the Srimad Bhagavatam, which we're discussing here, is universal. It's not a sectarian process. Sometime yesterday, when we were going around in around Tully Road, and we've got a shipment of books from Vietnam, Vietnamese books. So Dayanidhi Prabhu told us that we should go to Tully Road. So we went to Tully Road, and there was a mall there, and they had all Vietnamese signs there on all the shops. So we went from shop to shop, and we showed people the Bhagavad Gita, and the other book we got in Vietnamese was called Perfect Questions, Perfect Answers. And they loved it. But in some places, one place somebody said, yeah, but I'm a Buddhist. And I just explained, I said, oh, it's a universal principle. It's a universal principle. It's just like there's you can't use, you might say Russian gold, Australian gold, American gold, but gold is gold, isn't it? You just measure gold by how pure it is. That's all. You don't say Russian gold, American gold. You say, what quality of gold is it? Is it 24 karat gold? That means it's completely pure, I think. And then if you get, 11 karat gold down at Fisherman's Wharf in a chain, it'll turn green after a while. I've seen it. I knew somebody who sold those chains to tourists, and after a year or so and wearing it in the shower, it turned green because it's not pure gold. But if you have pure gold, it'll never tarnish, it'll never turn. So when we look at a spiritual process, we look and we say, what is the quality? First, what is the gold standard? What is the quality of purity? Srimad Bhagavatam says that this feeling of rasa exchange with the Supreme, with our infinite source, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it should grow through the process, whatever process, whatever part of the world, whatever culture, whatever book you're reading, it should foster in you a feeling of unmotivated, uninterrupted relationship through service. This is the standard of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Unmotivated, uninterrupted service to our source. And if we feel that in whatever process we're doing, then we're achieving something which is, it's the most coveted, the most sought after aspect of life. And it is worthy in all respects. And that's how the Srimad Bhagavatam directs us. That's how the Bhagavad Gita directs us, with this knowledge to bring us to the point of understanding the source and our relationship with that source. So in the beginning, it's called Sambandha Gyan. And this is a very beautiful word. Sambandha means our relationship. And if you think about how nice this is, if you're lost, if you wander away, for instance, children sometimes in a big crowded place, they'll wander away from their parents. And what a feeling that is. Did you ever wander away from your parents when you were a kid and get lost in a department store or something and they had to call for you? You did, Nirgula?
On the beach.
Which beach was that? Coney Island Beach, my wife got lost. Lucky they found her. We'd never have been married. Lucky for me, anyway. And so she got lost on Coney Island Beach, and they sent out people to find you? You better use the microphone. Give her the mic.
You know, there's a boardwalk there, and that beach is very crowded. People are lined up right next to each other. And I just remember some authority, you know, holding on to me till they found my parents.
It's scary, right? You get separated from your parents. It's scary. It's even scary when you're an adult. I got lost in Japan about 5 years ago. I was walking down. There's two rivers. I didn't know there were two. I thought there was one. So I was following the river. I thought, you can't go wrong following a river. But I did. I went across the street. I was going for miles and miles. And I said, okay, I'll turn around now. And said, there's the river. I started following it. After about an hour, I thought, this doesn't look anything like what it was before. And then, I was blissful when I was walking the other way. And coming back, my bliss was draining out. I was thinking, I got a flight to catch. I'm going to be late. I don't know where I am. And nobody understands what the heck I'm saying. I couldn't express myself properly. And now I know what the word lost is in Japan. Mayota. I was Mayota. And it's very disconcerting. Yes, Srivas.
Actually, we are all Mayota because we are under the influence of Maya. So,
Mayota, very good. Under the influence of Maya, an illusory idea, we're lost, and we don't know it, practically. Sambandha means to reorient myself. That's why we're looking to the Orient, to get reoriented. And we find out, what is my actual relationship? Where's my home? Where's my eternal home? Because this obviously isn't it. It's not my home. It's a temporary place. And Krishna describes it as temporary and full of miseries. So the Vedas are calling out to everybody and say, Tamasi ma jyotirgamai, find your home. Look towards the place of light, the place of warmth. If you're walking in the forest and you're lost and you're lost and you can't find your way and you think maybe I'll be consumed by an animal, maybe I'll die of exposure, and then after wandering and wandering you see a light coming from the forest, how do you feel? Light means home. It means there's somebody there, right? There's somebody in that house and you can call. You'll get on the internet and you'll tell them you're here and they'll come pick you up and you're saved. So this sambandha, the sambandha gyan means I'm wandering, I'm lost, and I've entered a marketplace, I've entered a forest, and I've lost my way. And that's the condition of this material life. I'm lost, I'm disoriented. And so the Vedas come to us as a light, and they say, remember your home, remember your relationship with your beloved, with the source of everything. That the one who is actually your eternal best friend, described as Suhrit, the friend who will do anything for you, who will follow you anywhere, who is your supplier, even though you've forgotten or turned away from that source, he still continues to supply you with everything. And so the Sambandha Gyan is a joyous thing, actually, realizing what is my relationship with that original person. And this is the greatest prospect in life, to realize this Sambandha Gyan, to become reoriented towards, this is what I want. This is the relationship to revive. And so this knowledge that we're getting from Prahlad Maharaj that he taught to his schoolmates gives us every possibility of reawakening, rekindling that relationship that we have with the Supreme. And for someone who has that, even if I'm still working hard in this world because of obligation, I'm born with a debt and therefore I must move in this world, once I realize that this is a temporary situation and my destination is beyond this temporary world, then there's, I can move in the world with joy in my heart and detach and a feeling of detachment because I know where I'm going. I know the destination. Reflections. Anything so far you heard from the reading or our discussion that stuck in your mind, one thing, and use the microphone because we're broadcasting. Yes, Patrick, next. Go ahead and then Patrick.
Hare Krishna.
Yes, Hare Krishna.
The Lord is providing for everyone. The Lord is providing for everyone.
Yes.
As you explained, the example of the birds in the field, they're not taking so much effort like human beings working in 9-to-5 jobs. And so I'm wondering, as human beings, we should do our duty, but we should not over-endeavor in life.
Nice reflection. And we should all take some homework. Can you take some homework? A little homework? Yes or no? I'm not convinced.
Yes.
Okay, so you have to go look at a bird. Go watch the birds. Jesus gave this kind of homework to his disciples, so it must be pretty good. So he said, go out in the field and look at the birds. Just watch them. It's kind of fun. Go out to a field somewhere, a tree or somewhere you can watch the bird. Just watch them for a minute. Take some time. You know, sometimes I miss everything. The sun's rising in the morning, biggest event of the day. I miss it. Why? I'm busy. But go look at the birds and just watch them and see how they're carefree. They're being supplied automatically. Patrick, reflection.
So, you know, the birds and the bees in the field, worry not, you'll be provided for. I once was lost in Krishna, I am found, and what amazing grace that truly is, you know, to think that we've been wandering in this field, didn't know where we were going, where we were from, and through that process of reflection and becoming conscious progressively more and more, we find our true selves in Krishna.
Nice. Nice reflection. Thank you. Gave me chills. Okay. Rakshit Jariwala Prabhu. Thank you, Patrick.
So you were mentioning about shine, and you said that it is sunshine. And in the Bhakti Shastri class, we were reviewing chapters in the Bhagavad Gita. I believe it was chapter 15, if I'm not mistaken, from 13, 14 to 15. But in one of the chapters, Krishna says that even the light of the sun and the moon is coming from me. It is borrowed light. And all luminous objects that are there, which are shining, that light is coming from the Lord. In fact, the material world would be a dark place. Even matter itself would be a dark place had it not been for the light of God to have entered into it. And that when we are looking at the material creation outside, it is actually is as such, the specimens there are reflecting the light of Krishna. So he has entered into the creation, and the shine or the light is really borrowed light that is coming from the body of Krishna.
Thank you. You've given us an excellent way to be conscious, and all consciousness means Krishna conscious, just by observing light everywhere that we see it, and remember that it's borrowed light. Very powerful. Thank you very much.
The source of our light?
Yeah, the sun, the name of our sun is soul.
Yes.
So it's interesting how there's so many commonalities on it.
Soul.
It's the name of our sun.
Yeah. Soul is the name of the sun. Yeah. And in the process of Vaishnava initiation, there are mantras that one receives that you may repeat three times a day during the sandhyas, which means the morning when the sun is rising, in the afternoon right when it's at its highest point, and in the evening when the sun is going down again. And each and the beginning mantra has an element of meditating on the sun and how it's the source of all life and how it's coming from God. And one thing that I note is when I say these mantras and prayers three times a day, that sometimes, although it's such a big deal and it's such an interesting thing to meditate on, at certain times of the day it can be more difficult because there are pressing matters going on. I'm being pulled along. And say the mantra, I have to actually consciously sit down and calm my mind and say, now meditate, think. And it shows there's a flow that pulls us away from this kind of consciousness of our environment and of the source of the sun and the moon and the water and everything else. And we must practice rekindling that awareness in various ways so we don't just get pulled away by the flow of the material energy, which comes through our mind, the flickering mind, which pulls us in various directions. One more reflection? Yes. Rajendra Kumar Prabhu.
Prabhuji, once I was traveling in a bus, so it so happened that a mother was there and she was there with her child, son child, and I think he was like 4 or 5 years old. So the bus stopped and she entered the bus. But then the child was distracted by something and he remained down. And then she realized, you know, that the sun is down and the doors were closing. So she shouted the driver and the sun came in, you know, and he was about to cry, you know. And then I heard them talking. So she asked, like, suppose you didn't, you hadn't been in the bus, so what would I have done? He said, I would have cried. So I was just thinking that unless if one doesn't get to understanding that he's lost, one won't cry. So I think that is the kind of reflection.
It's a nice reflection. In other words, it kind of goes with Srivas Pandit Prabhu's point about mayota or being in maya. If I don't realize the situation I'm in, that I'm actually lost, then I think, oh, everything's okay. I simply accept whatever kind of onslaught of material nature there is as normal. But when I hear about a different situation, I can transfer my attention and my intention to going there. Parastasmat tu bhavo nyo vyakto vyaktat sanatana. Yasmat sarveshu. No, wait. Parastasmat tu bhavo nyo vyakto vyaktat sanatana. Yaksak sarveshu bhuteshu nasyatsu navinashyati. In the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which is called Attaining the Supreme, Krishna discusses how the material creation is manifests, and then it gets destroyed, and it comes in cycles. It's secular. There are times of creation and times of destruction, and it comes and goes back and forth. And anyone who's set up shop here in this world is subjected to those changes constantly. Vyakta and avyakta means manifest and unmanifest. If I'm invested here, I've planted myself here, then I'm going to be disturbed. I remember playing on the beach when I was a kid, and my parents would warn me that all the hard work I was putting into a sandcastle would be ruined when the tide came in. It was really hard for me to believe that big ocean was going to come that far and take away my sandcastle. But it did. And when I hear in the Bhagavad Gita that all the planets are manifest and unmanifest, I think it looks fine now. I mean, the 101 freeways over there, it's operating today. But you can't think summer all summer. You have to think winter during the summer also. Ant philosophy. Ants are always getting ready for the next disaster. And that's the material world, actually. We're always preparing for the next disaster, retrofitting everything, you know, getting ready. And it's a very unstable place, actually. But I've accepted it as my home, and that's folly. So Bhagavad Gita is telling us, parastasmat tu bhavo nyo vyakto vyaktat sanatana. There's a superior abode. There's a better place. You want to go there? Better place? Yes. So it's like, unless you hear about it, it's like there's a much better place. If you get a crummy room in a hotel and someone comes, you got to they gave you the worst place. There's a much better place. All you have to do is go to the desk and, you know, tell them, and they'll move you. You know, it's like, I'm moving. So Krishna's saying, hey, this is a unstable place. It's not the best place. Parastasmat tu bhavonyo. There's a better place. It's not manifest and unmanifest. It's eternal. And it's superior in every way. So I hear about it, and then I can develop a desire to go there. This is part of sambandh gyan, my relationship. I don't have a relationship with this world anymore. I'm working in it. I'm doing my duty, but my heart is somewhere else. It's gone home, and my intention is to go home. I'm not interested anymore. I'm not charmed by this world anymore. That's the idea. We should become charmed by the spiritual world. When you hear about the spiritual world, you can become charmed by it. When you become charmed by hearing about Krishna's beauty, then you're a home-going person. When I'm charmed by this world, then I'm in Maya, Mayota. I'm lost. I'm staying. Yeah, that's true. When you're charmed by this world, it means your consciousness will keep you here because there's a reciprocation. Yeah. Yes, do you have a point, a question? Please pass her the microphone. And what is your name?
Kathy.
Kathy, welcome. Is your first time here?
Yes.
Welcome.
I was just wondering,
can you turn that on for her, please?
I was wondering what the difference was between depression, where you lose interest in a lot of things you took pleasure in before, and what you're describing, you know, where you realize there's a better home, you know, and the things of this world just don't have their appeal.
That's a nice question. Generally, in depression, there's a feeling, an overwhelming feeling that, first of all, that I'm no good and that nothing's any good. The whole world looks gray. This is it's sort of, I'm generalizing, but in most cases, depression, I'm not a psychologist, a disclaimer, but I've been depressed before, so I can speak from personal experience that everything just looks like it's not very good, and I'm not very good. And therefore, there may be an apparent detachment from the world, like out of disappointment, I can't move forward because nothing looks appealing to me. And the difference is that there's a higher taste in developing sambandha gyan, in developing a relationship with the higher thing, the higher world, the higher relationship. And I have something that's pulling me in another direction. And the detachment that I'm exhibiting for the world and the other activities that I used to perform is based on having something that's superior. And also, those who have a mature spiritual realization and attachment to the higher spiritual principle are not neglectful of their worldly duties. In other words, they don't just abandon things, they abandon their family, abandon their job and walk away. In fact, they become more expert because they're biding their time. And they do things efficiently because they don't want to become more entangled in the material world than they have to. That's the idea. There's a certain amount of work you have to do here because when we're born in the world, there's a debt we have to pay, and that's called, in Sanskrit, it's called karma. It carries over from our last life. We've taken enough facility so that we've racked up a bill. There's a tab. And, we may forget about it because we pass from one life to next, but then we come in this life and then someone says, you got to work hard because you got to pay off your tab. I say, wait a minute, I was just born. Why are you saving for a college fund? Because you got to work, man. In fact, you're going to support us, right? If you're in India, it's like you can get a job and you support us too. And so you're an indentured servant. When you're born into the world, there's a sort of a debt. And that, when you become spiritually realized and realize there's an alternative, there's another way, you don't leave behind all your debts. You do your duty, whatever you have to do, but your consciousness has gone elsewhere. Very interesting kind of esoteric example that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave to his disciples about this when they asked. And he had two disciples that were seemingly very worldly. They had become very high-placed ministers for a king. And in fact, they managed the whole kingdom because they were very, very bright. They knew 7-8 languages, and they were expert in politics and diplomacy and everything like that. So they were working. They were employed in that way, and then they got an idea through meeting this Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was teaching about Krishna consciousness, that they wanted to leave behind everything. And they, Hare Krishna Kalanka, nice to see you. Hare Krishna. They wanted to leave behind everything and go off with him. So, and you know, just abandon all their duties. So they informed him, and he wrote back a message to them. This was 500 years ago. And he told them, he gave them an example. He said, what if a, let's say, for instance, a housewife, and, you know, she's married and has a family, but then she has, on the side, all of a sudden, she develops an interest in a lover. And then she's doing her housework, but all the time, what she's really preoccupied with internally is she's thinking, I want to meet the lover. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, she'll be more expert at doing her daily work so she's not detected. And she'll do it efficiently, carefully, and not, you know, just dump everything and run away, but, you know, she'll be careful. Interesting example. Kind of a worldly example, but applies to spiritual life in a unique way, and that is that when one becomes charmed by the spiritual world and enthralled with the idea that I could actually go back to my eternal home and that this material world is actually a bothersome place, to say the least. And such a person goes on with their worldly duties in a dutiful way, performing them efficiently, and efficiently means as, you know, as little as possible, but getting the job done, and then concentrating the rest of their energy on this desire to go back, to be with God, to be with, you know, those who are connected to him, so on, like that. That answer your question? Okay, good. Hare Krishna. Dayaniti Prabhu, reflection. More question?
No, reflection, and that is that even if you're not desiring to serve God, that he is always giving you everything you need. No matter what, he's always giving you what you need. But if you do desire to serve God, then he's giving you all facility and all help to come back to him, because that's actually what he wants.
Nice. Yeah, this is something that Krishna speaks about in the Bhagavad Gita when he says, Sudridam Sarvabhutanam. And he says that one of the ways that one should and can think of Krishna is by remembering that he's our best friend. Best friend, and not only that, he's all-powerful. And he's the source of everything. I mean, it's not what you know, it's who you know. That's the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And if you know the person who, and he's your friend, he's your best friend, and he owns everything, and he controls everything, he's all-powerful, you're well situated. It's actually better than being the all-powerful, to have the friend who's all-powerful. Isn't it?
All the benefit, none of the responsibility.
All the benefit, none of the responsibility. That's it. Yeah. So we're actually in an ideal situation to revive a relationship with the all-powerful, all-merciful friend who's there. Vedas say he's so close. He's there within the heart. I'm only separated by consciousness. And that consciousness can be revived by hearing, by remembering, and by praying. And it's an open secret what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, how to direct one's life. It's good to have a goal. Moroseness, depression comes because of lack of a goal, unless it's some kind of chemical depression. But generally speaking, when I don't have a goal, I don't have an aim in life, then there's a sense of being adrift, If you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. And there's a bewilderment, especially nowadays, because there are a lot of distractions. And there are very few opportunities just to be at peace. The phone will always ring. There will always be something. So we need to have a goal to guide us in order to feel grounded and have peace. And that goal, Krishna recommends, is to remember that I'm the best friend and to reconnect through Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakto Madhyaji Mam Namaskuru. Very simple formula. He says, think of me. This is the first thing. Another reflection. Or is that somebody's car is blocking? Is that our car? Somebody's blocking the tinting garage outside. Eclipse, that's a good name for a car that's blocking the... Is another one blocking too? Is that a white car over here, a Toyota?
And it's a tinting shop.
It's a tinting shop. Manmana Pavamad Pakto. So, Bhagavad Gita, man means mind. Manmana. Manmana means, he says, think of me. This is the process of bhakti. So just think of me. So if you just think about Krishna, then everything good happens. Because where attention goes, energy flows. When we direct our attention towards Krishna, I was just hearing yesterday, actually, that one of the great Vaishnav scholars, Jiva Goswami, presented that every object has an effect on us. This is a science of vastu. Vastu means it expands into architecture, how we live. It is also very popular in America, this science of feng shui, of how the flow of your house and the energy of your house. And there are certain objects that you can place in your house to make the flow better. And the flow of energy. And every object that we encounter in this world has some effect on us. In fact, I told this to a guy yesterday in a bar. Yesterday we were going around shop to shop, and one of the shops we went into was a bar. And there was a couple of guys sitting way at the back in the dark, and they were playing some kind of poker game on the screen. And we went over and we showed them a Bhagavad Gita. Because an interesting surrounding, people were smoking and everything like that, and the guy said, "Well, I probably won't read this." And I said, "You don't have to read it because listen to this: every object has its effect on us. Doesn't matter what it is. Every object has some effect on our environment and on our consciousness when it's in our orbit." And he goes, "Yeah, okay, I can accept that." And I said, "Now, when you get a spiritual object, that has a spiritual effect on you, and that'll bring good fortune to your life." And this book is fully spiritual. It looks like paper and ink, but it's actually from the spiritual world, and it'll have a spiritual effect just as an object. You don't have to study this. I'm not going to quiz you on it. But if you take it home, it'll change your life. It'll change your house. Everything will be different. He goes, "Oh, I can accept that." And he bought the Bhagavad Gita. And Malini... When we came out of the bar, Malini said, "This is Nityananda's work, going into bars and selling Bhagavad Gitas." But it's a... yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's inconceivable sitting in the dark and doing these things. And anyway, when the light comes in, people become happy. They look satisfied and happy. But the fact is that a spiritual object... Yes, Shraddha, go ahead. I actually had no idea what I was going to say next.
Prabhuji, I was going to go back to your comment on how the birds are being cared for. Mm-hmm. And I just remembered about almost 25 years ago, I was in a training at a factory, and I used to take the factory bus to go to the factory. And it used to be a bus full of people, and nobody talked in the morning. Nobody. It was dead silence in the bus. And on the way back home in the evening, everybody was talking loudly. They were chattering. And then just a few days ago, I noticed nowadays the sun comes in early. So the birds, they make so much of noise in the morning. They are chirping, chirping, chirping. And it was such a contrast to how we are in the morning. Like, you know, all tensed up, what's going to happen in the office, don't want to talk to the spouse. And the birds, they are so very carefree. So that was one thing I noticed. And the second thing which I also observed right now was you're always happy going back home.
That's true. Yeah. And it's the weekend, and people are going home. That's true, too. You know, the spiritual world, you know, talk about weekend, it means freedom. Everyone works hard all week, and they're thinking, and if you talk to somebody on a Wednesday, and you say, how are you? A common answer is, oh, well, it's Wednesday, only a couple more days, only a couple more days. And this is what everyone wants, is some freedom. The spiritual world is total freedom. There's no law of karma. In fact, there's a description of Vaikuntha. Vaikuntha, spiritual world, means a place where there's no anxiety. Kuntha means anxiety, and Vaikuntha means no. It's no anxiety in that place. And there are airplanes. There are airplanes in the spiritual world, but they are for pleasure trips only. There's no cargo. There's no business people. I think about flying all the time as sort of a representation of what life is like in the material world, because it's a little microcosm. And when I fly United Airlines, they have two lines you can line up for at the gate. One line is the economy line, and the other line is the first class line. And there's only this much distance, because it's a rope that divides the two, and the only observable difference between the two places is that the first class line has a plastic red carpet. Really, they put a plastic red carpet on one side, and that's the first class line, and then the other line means the economy line. And everyone over on the first class line is looking over like, I'm on the first class line. That's my little plastic carpet right here. You guys stay over there. And then when they all go on, you get on the plane. And then the other thing is when they bring these carts around. They bring the carts around. And here's what you get in the material world. Not much. What's on the cart to drink? You got Coca-Cola. Whatever you want, you got Coca-Cola, Sprite, or whatever its representative is, 7-Up Sprite, that's it. There's two colors, red or white or black. And then maybe if you're lucky, there's cranberry juice or orange juice. That's it. And water. How many fruits are there in the world? Probably thousands to choose from. How many do you get on an airplane? Orange juice, that's it. Ask for grapefruit, we don't have grapefruit juice. And so it's a limited, paltry existence that we have. Whatever comes around, Prabhupada used to point out, even millionaires, billionaires, what do you get out of all that, ultimately? You can eat 4 chapatis. That's how much I can digest for. And if you have $1 billion, you can eat 4 chapatis. If you have 5 cents, you can still eat 4 chapatis. It's the same experience of eating and digesting. So the material world's a very limited idea. When the cart comes by here, you don't get very much. But in the spiritual world, it's full abundance. For instance, described how the trees in the spiritual world are kalpavriksha trees. They're wish-fulfilling trees. They're not stationary either. They move, they can walk. And everything's fully conscious in the spiritual world. And the kalpavriksha trees, they can give you anything you want. So regular tree here, you ask for avocado, that's what you better ask for it. That's an avocado tree, because that's what you get, right? But a kalpavriksha tree can give you anything you want. Interesting observation about Vrindavan. In Vrindavan, in Goloka or Gokula Vrindavan, the trees are all wish-fulfilling trees, but nobody wants anything. They're not asking. They have no desire to fulfill. So Chaitanya Charitamrita says that Krishna Bhakti Nishkam Atayiva Shanta Bhukti Mukti Siddhi Kami Sakali Ashanta, that the bhaktas, those who are fully absorbed in love for their supreme friend, they have no desire to fulfill, and therefore they're peaceful. Bhaktas are peaceful. And those who have desire for anything else, they're not peaceful, always disturbed. So it's not that we extinguish desire, but we must transfer our desire from material desire to spiritual desire, and that is the process of Krishna consciousness. It grows through this sambandha jnana, which we're hearing from the Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, sambandha, which means reestablishing our relationship with our home and with the supreme friend and source of everything, Krishna. And as we move in a practical way towards reviving that relationship, this is called abhideya. We actually act in a way, but through which we can reestablish that relationship with our infinite source, our supreme friend. And those are the activities of Krishna consciousness. This is why we do what we do. There are 64 items of devotional service mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion. And each one of those items is a practical daily way that you can live that connects you to thinking about Krishna or meditating on Krishna, serving Krishna, becoming Krishna's devotees. And there's an example right here. You see he's absorbed in playing the flute. So unless there's a final question or reflection that someone wants to get in before we end, then we will go to the next part of our program, which is an arti ceremony. Arti means that we're offering various elements to Krishna. Krishna is all-powerful, and he can appear in any way that he likes. And one of the ways that he appears, he can appear within wood, stone, metal, paint, within your mind. And one of the ways he appears before us is in the form of his deity, so that we can think of him and offer him things. Someone might say, well, that's stone. Like one man, when I was up in Toronto at the Urban Edge Yoga, I gave a small talk there about mantra meditation, and a man came up to me afterwards and he said, you know, I think the devotees are nice and everything like that, but what's with the dolls? Why do you guys worship dolls? And I said, you must mean the deities in the temple and things. And he goes, yeah, but come on. You know, how can you explain that? And I said, very simply, listen, if you're going to mail a letter, you have to put it in a box, but you can't put it in any box. You go outside with a letter, you have to put a stamp on it, and you go and you look for a U.S. postal box, and it has the mark of U.S. Postal Service on it. It's a certain color, and it's in an official location. And because you put your letter in that official box and it's authorized, your letter will go to its destination. And similarly, because we are worshiping Krishna in an authorized way, and he himself talks about how to approach him in this deity form in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's detailed explanation of what deity worship is, how to do it, and that's what we're doing. Because of that, there's a transference of our affection and our devotion, and Krishna accepts it through this form. He actually comes to us in this form, as he has every right to do, because he's all-powerful. And someone said, well, God's everywhere. Why do you worship in the temple? Well, he's God's everywhere. Why don't you worship in the temple? Why not, if he's everywhere? He's also in the temple, right? So Krishna appears in this form of the deity, and we have a regulated process of serving the deity. It's not willy-nilly. It's not according to our own schedule or whims, but the devotees who are on the schedule for worshiping the deities do it in a certain, very practical way. And in this way, there's also this sambandha, or relationship with Krishna, is awakened. So the next ceremony is an arti ceremony where we offer various elements from the earth, which are represent our gratitude in offering back to Krishna various things. Like we start off with blowing a conch shell, so the sound vibration we're offering, and then we have some incense. So incense represents the fragrance of the earth, punyo ganda prativyam cha, the fragrance that all comes from the earth, and then we have fire. offering the element of fire. And then what do we have? Water. And then you have, we offer a cloth. And there's flowers. And then the whisk represents the subtle elements, like the mind and ether and things like that. And the fanning, it's like there's air. So all the elements we could offer to Krishna in that way. And he reciprocates when we offer him something. And then everyone in the audience is singing and chanting Krishna's name in a mantra. And this is also an authorized mantra. It's not just a made-up sound, but it comes from the Vedas. And the Vedas are eternally manifest. They are spiritual sounds that are actually codes. They're spiritual formula which are meant to liberate our mind. Mantra means the mind-delivering formula. And so we chant the Hare Krishna mantra, which is the most recommended mantra in the age of Kali Yuga. And it comes from the Kali Santarana Upanishad. The Upanishads are part of the Vedas. And this mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra, is specifically mentioned as the panacea, the medicine for the age of Kali, to destroy any obstacles that you have. And it will deliver you. It's a mantra that will deliver you from all material suffering. Just in the very beginning, this is just the early stages of the curative effect of the mantra. It will deliver you from all the ills and problems and suffering of the material world, just at the very edge and as it starts to take effect. And then in the end, just by the mantra, we can redevelop our eternal relationship with Krishna and develop full-blown love for God by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. So we combine these two, the offering to the deity and also the chanting of the mantra. All this makes there's a tumultuous sound, and all of that sound vibration is spiritual. It all goes into our heart, into all the pores of our body. And by this, we become transformed. And this is the process of bhakti yoga that's easy, so easy that the children will even be dancing and can take advantage. If we were going off to the forest to meditate, they'd be running all over the place, disturbing our meditation. But in this, they can feel happy to participate. So a child can do it. And if someone's in a wheelchair and they can't even move their jaw anymore, they can also come in and feel the vibration. That's the power of the process of bhakti yoga. So that's what we're going to do right now. We're going to put all the books away, and we're going to put all the asanas away. We'll stand up. We have some instruments that we'll play and we'll sing. And after that, there'll be a couple of announcements. And then there'll be a feast of spiritual food served to everybody, courtesy of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thank you very much. Gopremanande Haribo.